From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President-elect Joe Biden is planning to outline his vaccine plan today. He wants 100 million vaccine doses administered in his first 100 days in office. Yesterday, he outlined a $1.9 trillion rescue and recovery package with the goal of fighting the pandemic, sending funding to states, and giving direct payments to individuals.
Direct cash payments, extended unemployment insurance, rent relief, food assistance, keeping essential frontline workers on the job, aid to small businesses. These are the key elements to the American Rescue Plan that would lift 12 million Americans out of poverty.
Of course, the plan first has to pass Congress. We've asked Jason Furman to give us his take on the idea. He is professor of economics at Harvard. He was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Obama administration. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of the bill, and what do you think the most important parts of it are to you?
It's an incredibly bold proposal, larger than anything we've ever done before in response to an economic crisis, larger than anything happening anywhere else in the world. I think it's welcome, and I think of it as having three important things. Number one, funding and controlling the virus. Number two, getting our economy going again. And number three, a real down payment on a structural reform to reduce child poverty.
Let's talk about that. You said it's the most impressive and ambitious child poverty plan ever in the United States. How would it work? What specifically are you talking about there?
Right. The most important is that right now we have a tax credit, which is $2,000 per child. But if you're very low income, you don't get the full $2,000. In fact, you might get no money at all. And what he proposes is to raise it to $3,000 a child and to make it a cash check that everyone who would get, even low-income households, be $3,600 for families with smaller children. And that comes together with other proposals like raising the minimum wage and expanding the earned income tax credit.
Right. It would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The Congressional Budget Office, though, has estimated that while it could raise wages for 17 million workers, it also cost 1.3 million jobs. So the question is now a good time to raise the minimum wage when so many small businesses are hurting?
Yeah, I think now is a good time to pass legislation to raise the minimum wage. You want to make sure that you're phasing it in over time so that businesses and the economy have the ability to adjust to it. I certainly wouldn't, jump up to $15 an hour right now, which for many businesses would work just fine. But for a lot of small businesses in a lot of parts of the country, that would be too high too fast.
I wonder about the Moody's report that says this approach by Joe Biden will create 18 million jobs in his first term. Do you see that same kind of job windfall?
Well, we're about 11.5 million jobs short of where we are now. And then on top of that, you'd normally want about 1.5 million jobs a year. So that Moody's number is basically saying that with this plan, we'd get to where we should get, make up that hole that we're in, and then keep growing with the economy. I think that's very plausible.
So how about the overall price tag, $1.9 trillion? What would you tell people who are very concerned about spending that's just too much money right now?
Yeah. So the size will get adjusted in the congressional process. I think this is probably a ceiling. I personally think if it went down a little bit, it would still be a lot of money, and that would be okay. But broadly speaking, the United States has the fiscal room to do something like this. We can afford to because interest rates are incredibly low. In fact, we're borrowing at lower than the rate of inflation. So when we borrow money today, we're repaying money that's less valuable than it a decade ago. It's a little bit like the financial market screaming out that they want more of this to happen. They care more about a strong economy than they do about the borrowing. And I certainly think we should all feel the same way.
So still, there are a lot of questions about whether it will pass, how much of it will pass. What would you say Americans can expect if it does pass? How will their lives be different?
The most important is that, you know, people will get vaccines sooner. They're more likely that if their children get back to school and are getting tested for COVID in school, and that our lives are returning to normal more quickly. The second thing you'd notice is, you know, you'd get a check if your income wasn't above the threshold. You would get unemployment insurance if you lose your job. Your city is less likely to...
Thank you, though. Jason Furman, professor of economics at Harvard. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The president of Mexico is taking a stance against social media companies in much the same way President Trump has. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is promising to lead an international effort to combat censorship after several platforms blocked President Trump for his role in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Femi Okey is our social media expert and host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Peter.
What's the president of Mexico doing here? Yeah.
There's been some surprise about the Mexican president's stance, that he's been so outspoken on this issue. He's even called social media's clampdown on people like President Trump a little bit like the Spanish Inquisition. People online are saying, well, references like this: Mexico is struggling with the COVID pandemic, drug cartels, femicide. You really should focus perhaps on your own issues. Rebecca Roth, though, takes on this idea about free speech and President Trump's ban. When you sign up for an account, she posts, you're agreeing to the terms of service. You break those terms, you can be on the platform, and you get thrown off the platform. It's pretty simple. Also posted on Twitter that President Trump can have press conferences like every president did before Twitter. President López Obrador has got about 8 million Twitter followers on Twitter and about 8 million on Facebook. So he's a pretty heavy social media user, Peter.
He is, but he's also a populist, so maybe his response is not entirely surprising. Even more reserved politicians like the German Chancellor Angela Merkel have also criticized social media companies for banning the president. What kind of threads are you seeing elsewhere around the globe?
You're getting a really good idea of what this social media ban is revealing from other governments around the world. So the European Commissioner, for instance, calls this a 9/11 moment on social media. The French economy and finance minister calls the social media companies the digital oligarchy. But have a look, everybody, at Jack Dorsey's tweet. He's the CEO of Twitter, of course. He says, explains the ban. He says it's partly due to Twitter's failure to reinforce healthy conversation. And Jack Dorsey himself says that this sets a precedent I feel is dangerous because it gives an individual corporation power over a global public conversation. And I'm just going to leave that conversation there, apart from noting that the download apps charts have had an uptick for social media apps like MeWe, CloudHub, and Telegram. They're doing really well this week.
You know, on the same lines here, last week you and I talked about citizen detectives who were trying to track down people who were involved in the Capitol insurrection. And that story is developing because now the detective work is spreading, Femi, to dating apps. Tell me about that.
Some of the big dating platforms have filters that you can apply so that you're matched with someone who shares your worldview. So users, for instance, can filter out potential dates if they ever agree or disagree with their political stances. So apps like OkCupid, Hinge, and Bumble have a sort of political filter. That's good background to know. Aaliyah's tweet, I'm just going to use her first name. Aaliyah's tweet came out a little while ago, and she says there are dozens of men on DC dating apps right now who were clearly here for the insurrection attempt.
Wow.
Some say it directly, others are obvious from MAGA clothing, location tags, etc. Is this information useful at all for law enforcement? Other people jump in. Allison says she knows people who are matching with MAGA bros on Bumble, and they're bragging and sending their pics and videos of them, of the Capitol riot. And then she's screen grabbing them and sending them to the FBI. JC comments, this is the best possible use of a dating app. And then before everybody gets super excited about this, I would say honey trap detective work, Bumble steps in on Thursday and says, we have temporarily removed our politics filter in the US to prevent misuse. Don't worry, it will be reinstated in the future.
Oh my gosh. I admit this transition is going to be tough, but we got to do it.
The internet, you for doing it, Peter.
We'll try. We don't have much time here, but the internet is remembering Joanne Rogers, who was a pianist, yeah. but also, of course, the wife of the beloved children's television host, Mr. Rogers. What are you hearing about her?
Oh, the memories and the beautiful tweets and remembrances are still coming in. Just before I jumped online with you, I saw this one from cellist Yo-Yo Ma. He posted, "May her journey rejoining Fred be accompanied by lots of laughter, music and joy." And Mr. Adler shares this remembrance from Joanne Rogers. "I don't mean to sound boastful, but he was my own icon before he was anyone else's. Being Mrs. Fred Rogers has been the most remarkable life I could ever have imagined."
And we are hearing her play the piano here. Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice said this week that 100% of the coronavirus doses that the state has received have either been administered or are scheduled to be administered to a specific person. Here he is on CNBC.
"We don't have vaccines in a warehouse sitting on a shelf. We've got them in people's arms."
West Virginia continues to lead the country in the number of people per capita who've been vaccinated against COVID-19. So let's bring in one of the people in charge of making sure that's happening. Retired Major General James Hoyer joins us now. Welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. So when the governor says 100% of the vaccines distributed to the state have either been administered or have a specific name attached to them, is that right? That's no exaggeration.
Yes. So what we did early on was working from the local level all the way up is as our vaccines come in and get ordered on that Thursday rhythm with Operation Warp Speed, we work with entities to go ahead and identify those two specific populations and people in West Virginia. And we're on track right now. We've been averaging 86% execution rate, meaning shots in arms a week. But this week we will far surpass that. And I think part of that is having those people identified to get those vaccines.
Okay, help me better understand how you're doing that, because depending on what metric you're looking at, West Virginia is right at the top of the country of getting these vaccines into people's arms. I don't fully understand how you're doing that, though.
Yeah, so I think it goes back to two things early on. Governor Justice pulled a group of us together, and the governor pushed us to laid out four key priorities. Reduce the rate of hospitalizations, reduce the rate of deaths, protect the most vulnerable, and maintain critical services to include acute healthcare services we know we need for our population based on the demographics of age and the health issues we have. And by combining those priorities with that construct and then going after and building a network to deliver the vaccines, I think that's where we had success early on.
Well, one of the things I think you're doing is that you're using a local network of pharmacies across the state of West Virginia, not necessarily relying on the big companies like Walgreens or CVS like other states. Is that right? And what kind of difference is that making?
So, yeah, I think what we did was not just limit ourselves to the two pharmacies that were in the federal pharmacy program, was to use every pharmacy in West Virginia, as well as regional clinics, federally qualified health clinics, hospital clinics, and we are building out the network of primary care folks across the state. And if you look at it, in the beginning of this, we pushed vaccines to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, ICUs, and COVID wards, because we knew that was what was going to get us at those priorities. Now what we're doing is, in addition to pushing, we're creating a pull construct where a federally qualified clinic knows how many patients they have over the age of 80 and how many patients 70 to 80. They can start to create those pull constructs of identifying those individuals and say, we're going to have X number of vaccines come this week. We need you to come to get this. And then the other thing that we're going to have to do in West Virginia is, because we have some vulnerable population that are not mobile, is to be able to get out to them. Regional clinics are going to be important, but all the way down to local health departments are going to be important as well.
And what about the National Guard? What role will they be playing?
We've got National Guardsmen who are working side by side with local health departments and our Department of Health and Human Resources to do epidemiology data. And we've got National Guard young men and women who are managing the doses as they come into those hubs and then getting them delivered out to the right places. The burn rate of PPE, we are now making our own PPE. So if we have another hospital surge, we can be able to take care of ourselves.
Oh, wow. And that could be a lesson for other states who are not quite as advanced here on this issue as you are. Now, we also heard your governor say that West Virginia needs more vaccines. Are you satisfied with the federal government's response to your request? Are you getting what you need from the feds?
I was on multiple calls this past week with my governor where he was pressing the federal apparatus to get us more vaccines. As the governor tells me every day, you know, Jim, every shot we get in an arm is potentially saving a life. So we need more vaccines. We would like to, you know, we're going to get 23,600 first doses for next week. If we had 110,000 doses, we could move them out and get them done.
Wow. Retired Major General James Hoyer leading West Virginia's COVID-19 vaccination drive. So far, it sounds like it's going pretty good. Thank you, sir, for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a great day.
The pandemic has been disruptive for parents of school-aged children who had to deal with the education question in the fall. That is, should they send their kids back to school in person or keep them at home and let them learn remotely? Or a third option, keep the children home and the parents will do the teaching. In fact, the number of families homeschooling their kids is on the rise nationwide. Amy Firesell from North Country Public Radio reports.
On Thursdays, Sarah Schaff and her daughter Iris study math in the morning and take a hike in the afternoon. Somewhere in the day, 8-year-old Iris might fit in one of her art projects, like miniature holiday dioramas.
Hanukkah, Day of the Dead, Easter. They're like little, just teeny little drawings. Like there's for Thanksgiving, there's a little cornucopia.
Sarah and her husband Ben, both professors in Plattsburgh in northern New York, have been homeschooling Iris since the fall. They didn't feel comfortable sending her to school in person. They also couldn't imagine continuing remote learning.
That screen time was really stressful for her and for us too. And there's so many tears.
They're using a mix of online curricula, textbooks, and Iris's own interests, including ancient Egypt and women scientists. Schaff says while homeschooling Iris has been rewarding, it's also been really difficult to balance it with her and her husband's full-time jobs.
You know, we have to make up a lot on the weekends and the evenings. It is not possible to do everything well, and parents are naturally going to want to put their kids' well-being first.
In the past, the decision to homeschool has been a deliberate one, whether for religious or secular reasons. But in 2020, a lot of families that never dreamed they'd homeschool their kids have found themselves doing just that. The National Homeschool Association says they've seen membership explode from 20,000 to 200,000 members. Director Alan Weston says they've been flooded with calls and emails from parents saying,
we need to really focus on doing this for real. So what do we need to know and what do we need to do?
Weston says lots of parents are looking for homeschool curricula, which is why his organization recently launched a curriculum match service.
I call it a dating site to bring the parents together with the vendors. They each fill out their own questionnaires. The parents say, this is what we're looking for.
The whole world of online learning resources has seen a big bump in business since the pandemic, says Jennifer Gu. Gu is the COO of Education.com and IXL Learning, a K-12 curriculum platform for common subjects like math and social studies. It's used by over 11 million students.
I think it definitely propelled a lot of customers. I think everyone is looking for online resources.
Smaller companies have also been riding the surge. Amir Nathu is the co-founder and CEO of OutSchool, a venture-backed startup in San Francisco. They've offered live video chat classes with a teacher and 3 to 8 students since 2017.
When the pandemic hit, we had more experience with offering this kind of learning than any other organization in the U.S.
Kids can take a class on the 5-paragraph essay, but they can also sign up for Learn Critical Thinking through Dungeons & Dragons. OutSchool has experienced huge growth since last March, says Nathu.
We're approaching 100 million in sales. You know, the teacher base has grown from 1,000 teachers to 10,000 teachers, and we had to scramble to get so many more teachers on the platform because of the jump in demand.
OutSchool has conducted several internal surveys to try and understand how their classes are being used. Nathu says they found that 60% of parent members would not send their kids back to school until there was a widely distributed vaccine. And 40% said they would seriously consider homeschooling past the pandemic.
So clearly there's been a big shift in parents' perception about education and a lot more interest in alternative and supplemental services like OutSchool.
Curriculum providers acknowledge that they'll lose a lot of their new customers post-vaccine when schools are able to fully resume. But they also say COVID-19 has already disrupted conventional education practices and exposed parents and educators to alternatives. While most students are still enrolled in their local school districts, there are a growing number of families trying homeschooling who might not have otherwise, like Sarah Schaff's family in Plattsburgh. As hard as it is, she says they're sticking with homeschooling Iris this spring.
She will always say, when we do check-ins, you know, how is it going? Do you miss school? She'll say yes. Do you want to do remote learning? She says emphatically, always no way.
For Here and Now, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
New polls show that President Trump's base is standing by him despite last week's deadly violence at the Capitol. A new survey from Republican pollster Frank Luntz found that 91% of the people he polled would vote for Trump again. Frank Luntz joins us now. Frank, welcome.
Welcome. And you know, that's not the most striking statistic in the survey. We found that exactly 50% of those who voted for Donald Trump in 2020 wanted him, this is as of Monday, wanted him to continue to contest this election. Not 2024, but 2020. They are not giving up. They are standing behind him. And this is a pretty angry group of people who are very concerned about the days, weeks, and months to follow.
Does that surprise you, considering everything that's just happened?
I was shocked. But after doing a focus group last night, I realized that they don't blame him for what happened in the Capitol. They don't hold him accountable for the things that he has said or things that he has done. That somehow they've managed to suspend reality. And I don't want to criticize all of them because this isn't all of them, but the polling showed 60% believe that they will never trust an election again. 67% believe that the election was stolen, and 73% have similar a point of view that if all the votes had been counted accurately, that Donald Trump would have won. those numbers are going up, not down. There are more and more Trump people who are rejecting the results today than 30 days or 60 days ago.
Okay, Frank, that sounds like a problem. First of all, for the Republican Party, but maybe even more so for the country.
I agree with that, and this is very frightening to me. Now, this is not the first time this has happened. Back in 2000, about 30% of the Democrats did not believe that George W. Bush had defeated Al Gore. But that was half of what we have right now, and you didn't have the same kind of intensity, the same kind of passion. And last night in this focus group, we found that there was no desire from Trump voters to get along with the Democrats, no desire to work together. And when you add that up, the polling data and the focus group data, you've got 46% of the country who voted for Trump feeling like they've been robbed, like they've been mistreated. And it's going to take years to bring these people back into the political process again.
Frank, you do these focus groups. You spend a lot of time speaking with Republicans. You have for years. Can you posit a theory about why they can't hear the message that is undeniably true, that this election was fair?
Well, I got agitated. I will admit that I got agitated with the respondents yesterday, and that's not my job. I need to listen to them. But I heard quite clearly they don't trust the media at all. Many of them have come not to trust Fox News. So the only people they're hearing from is Donald Trump until his Twitter got shut down, and maybe OAN and Newsmax. But they're getting no information whatsoever that challenges their beliefs. And most of their friends are Trump voters. We found that also out in the survey. So that it's this echo chamber, this reinforcement day by day, that makes them more and more intent. And this is very problematic. You're correct. We should be afraid as a country.
Republican pollster and political strategist Frank Luntz, thank you.
More than 20,000 National Guard troops are in Washington, D.C. prior to next week's inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Law enforcement officials are also beefing up security in all 50 states. That's after the FBI warned there could be armed protests in the coming days. In Wisconsin, the governor is mobilizing the National Guard to protect the state capitol building in Madison. Officials have already boarded up the ground floor windows there. We're joined by Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Bridget Bowden. Hi, Bridget.
Hi.
Police in Madison have said that there is a demonstration planned at the Capitol building this Sunday. But as you have reported, it's over a different issue. This is the decision not to charge the Kenosha police officer who shot Jacob Blake, leaving the man paralyzed. What are officials saying about the chance of protest by Trump supporters coming up?
Right. So local law enforcement here, as well as state and federal law enforcement, are on the lookout for potential armed marches, as the FBI warned, we could see that at state capitals. But as of yesterday, they weren't aware of any specific threats in Madison. The police chief had a press conference yesterday where both he and the mayor here said that as of now, they're not aware of anything specific.
So nothing specific yet, but they are taking measures, including, as we said, boarding up the ground floor windows. What else are they doing to heighten security around the Capitol?
That's correct. So the lower level windows were boarded up, and the administrators that are in charge of the state capitol building sent out a memo earlier this week encouraging everyone who works in that building to work from home over the next days if possible. They also yesterday placed some concrete barriers outside of the building. Not a complete fence, but that if you walk around the building, you can see some concrete barriers in place.
The State House has been the site of protests before. Back in 2011, demonstrators actually took over the building during protests against a measure to end collective bargaining for the state's public workers. Those protests were mostly peaceful. Are state officials there confident that security will be adequate if things get violent this time around?
That is what they have said so far, both state and local officials, as well as law enforcement. And you're right. The state capitol is no stranger to protest activity. It's almost the place to protest if you're going to protest in Wisconsin. And there have been some quite large protests, including the ones that you mentioned in 2011, which lasted for weeks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Bridget Bowden. Thanks, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got some updates from Washington on the country's pandemic response. Today, President-elect Joe Biden tapped former FDA Chief David Kessler to lead the government's vaccination program. And last night, Biden unveiled his nearly $2 trillion rescue plan that included $20 billion for vaccine rollout.
We'll have to move heaven and earth to get more people vaccinated, to create more places for them to get vaccinated, to mobilize more medical teams to get shots in people's arms, to increase vaccine supply, and to get it out the door as fast as possible.
There are still many months to go before this pandemic is under control. Let's bring in Dr. Helen Chu, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Washington. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
Mike Ryan, a top official for the World Health Organization, warned this week that the second year of this pandemic could be even tougher than the first. Do you agree with that?
I don't know that I do. With the emergence of new variants, there's certainly some evidence that there will be increased transmission over the next several months. But I anticipate that we'll get to a point of fairly complete vaccine rollout over the next 3 to 4 months. And by the summer, the pandemic will be under better control.
Oh, really? So at the rate we're going right now, you expect that the U.S. will have vaccinated enough people to put the brakes on this thing? You're saying by the summer?
I would hope so. I mean, there's a lot of unpredictability in that number. It depends on how quickly the vaccine rollout will escalate after the administration changes over, of course. But I don't think that this year will be worse than last year.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. 10 million people in the U.S. have now gotten their first COVID-19 shot. At the same time, we've got reports of technical glitches, supply chain issues, and bureaucracy making it tough for people to get those shots quickly. Joe Biden is coming into office with this big, ambitious plan, 100 million doses in 100 days, he says. And I do know that some states are skeptical that he's going to be able to pull that off. What do you think?
You know, it's a matter of logistics. So if you have the staff to be able to do the vaccination, the space to do the vaccination, and the logistics of getting the vaccine to the places where it needs to be deployed, then that is possible. Whether or not that can be done that quickly, I hesitate to say that that will happen. I think it's going to take time. And we are just in a situation where, you know, a lot of the work that needed to be done should have been done over the last 6 to 8 months, but unfortunately, it was not prioritized.
From a purely practical point of view, as people get vaccinated, they're going to have a lot of questions about what they can and can't do. For instance, I just scheduled my father, who's 75, I just scheduled his vaccine for later this month. And I think to myself, great, as soon as he gets it, you know, soon we'll be able to just hang out and do whatever we've done before. I won't have to worry about getting him sick. What do we need to know? Do we still need to be really careful with our loved ones, for instance, once they've been vaccinated? What can we and can't we do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot that we don't know yet about what the vaccine can do versus cannot do. What we do know is that once you get your two doses in of the mRNA vaccines, you are protected from severe infection and you're protected from getting sick with the virus. But what we don't know is whether or not you are going to be protected from having asymptomatic infection, so having the virus but not having any symptoms, and therefore at risk to pass it on to others.
So I wouldn't necessarily have to worry about getting him sick, but he could still get me sick, potentially.
That's correct. Generally, though, when you have a vaccine that is that effective, though, 95%, you can expect that it's going to partially protect from transmission. There are a couple of cases from the early results from Moderna and Pfizer that suggest that this does protect against asymptomatic infection. But those numbers are very, very small. So I would not say that based on those numbers, you can make the conclusion that getting the vaccine protects you from infecting others.
Okay. So, you know, as students are pretty deep now into their second school year of this pandemic, which seems hard to believe, I know you've been studying transmission on college campuses and in schools. What have you found so far about whether reopening is a good idea and if it can be done safely?
So here in Seattle, we haven't had public schools open since March. So I don't know that there are data here locally to support public school reopening. There have been a couple of recent studies that have been published, though, from North Carolina, and then also the CDC released a report yesterday that looked into the number of cases in younger children. And the assumptions that you can make are that if you use good PPE, ventilate, clean surfaces, wear masks, social distance, all of those things, there's actually very little evidence of transmission in schools and very little evidence that students are transmitting to teachers.
Now, you've also been studying the transmission of COVID among the homeless in Seattle. What are you learning there?
I think the homeless population is interesting because we thought of the homeless population as more likely to get sick from coronavirus, but we haven't actually found that to be the case. And we haven't found evidence of sustained transmission in the homeless shelters like I would have predicted. Hmm. And I think part of that is due to a few things. One is that we think that there has been probably good measures that have been taken in place in these shelters to prevent ongoing transmission. So, for example, once a case is identified, that person is removed from the shelter and put in isolation. And I also think that probably in this population, there is a higher burden of asymptomatic infection that we probably haven't detected. And that's actually pretty surprising to me. I would have expected that individuals who are homeless with all of these chronic medical problems would have been sicker, and that hasn't really borne out.
Dr. Helen Chu, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the University of Washington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's take a break from the chaos in the country right now to turn to something lighter to end the hour. Why the heck not? We learned this week that HBO is going to produce a 10-episode revival of Sex and the City. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about this reboot that for some people is a dream come true. Eric, Sex and the City returns. What's that going to look like?
Yeah, one way in which the show's going to be different is that it won't feature Kim Cattrall, the actress who played Samantha, who in some ways, you know, brought a lot of sexiness to Sex and the City. The actress, Kim Cattrall, has been open about how she doesn't get along with star Sarah Jessica Parker, and she wasn't interested in doing any more iterations of the show. But, you know, we have a clip that sort of gives a sense of how she embodies some of the qualities of the show, where she talks a little bit about her attitude when it comes to being a professional in the city. Let's check it out.
Samantha Jones was a New York inspiration, a public relations executive. She routinely slept with good-looking guys in their 20s.
Mm. Remember that guy that I was going out with? Oh, God, what was his name?
Drew.
The sex guy. Right. Well, afterwards, I didn't feel a thing. It was like, hey, babe, gotta go. Catch you later. And I completely forgot about him after that.
That's a scene from the first episode. So, Eric, about Sex and the City, it broke a lot of taboos when it debuted in 1998 with female characters talking so openly about their sex lives. But so much has changed since then. Do you think that it's a wise move to bring back the show that's focused so squarely on these white, wealthy women who go around in expensive high heels?
I think if it's a show about that, yeah, then it's probably a mistake. But hopefully they will have decided that there's some other story that they want to tell. You know, the original show was so much about these women who were growing into their lives. They were getting married. They were thinking about raising a family. And it ended with the lead character, who was famously single, finally connecting with the love of her life. So if they are able to talk about the taboo things about middle-aged women that we still don't talk about now, I think it could be a really compelling show. But it all depends on whether how they ride that line between reminding you of what the old show was like, but also finding a way to take it forward and talk about new topics. And they also have to explain why Samantha's not in the picture in a way that doesn't disappoint fans or anger people who like that character. You know, they've set a very high bar for themselves. It'll be interesting to see if they can clear it.
Eric, I know there are also some new shows that you think have been overlooked that you want to talk about, including Netflix documentary The History of Swear Words. It's hosted by Nicolas Cage, and here's a clip from the show that the FCC will not get mad at us for playing.
The sweariest actor isn't Samuel L. Jackson, Al Pacino, or my personal favorite, Yosemite Sam, but Jonah Hill. And while Jonah Hill is known for his R-rated comedies, it was The Wolf of Wall Street that made him the king of the curse words, swearing a confounding 107 times in that movie alone.
And we won't hear them. What did you think of the documentary? Does all that swearing offer some kind of catharsis?
Well, let me first say that I was looking forward to the challenge of talking about this show on radio without getting a huge FCC fine for everybody who aired the program. Basically, this is a really smart and informative documentary about the history of profanities that is spiced with comments from comedians and performers. What you get is this really interesting look at where the boundaries of society are and how they change over time. What do we consider profane in one moment but not consider profane in another? How does it change depending on who uses the profanity? When a woman uses the B word, is that different than if a man uses it? So this is something people might have missed because it dropped on Netflix like 2 days before the Capitol attack. But it's worth taking a look at, especially if you want to get a little bit of an escape from some of the crazy news headlines of the day.
One more to talk about. You're a fan of Apple TV Plus's Dickinson, which is a historical drama based on the life of poet Emily Dickinson. Its second season came out last week. Did you like it?
It's a really interesting show. Basically, it's a show that tries to talk about what Emily Dickinson's life must have been like as she was starting to write poems and decide that that's what she wanted to do. But it's told with a very contemporary veneer. All the music is modern, and even the sensibilities of the characters are kind of modern. So it's almost like a CW kind of rendition of Emily Dickinson's genesis. And there's a funny scene in the first episode of the second season where her eyesight is starting to fail and her dad has taken her to a really expensive doctor and is a little disappointed with the diagnosis that he winds up with. Let's check it out.
This was a lot of money to pay for a bit of impossible advice. Afford the sun? She's not a bat, you know.
Dad, it's okay. I don't need the sun. I still have the moon.
Emily, hush. Can't you see I'm in the middle of shouting at this man?
If you like, you could stay a couple more days. I could conduct further observation.
I want to go home.
Let me just present you with the bill.
Oh, you're a crook.
I'm actually America's very first ophthalmologist.
So, you know, the characters kind of refer in a knowing way, you know, to the historical nature of it, that sometimes they break the fourth wall. Again, it's something that could be a little escapist that people could watch to maybe take their mind off of what's happening in government right now.
I don't know what you're talking about. NPR TV critic Eric Dickens, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.